This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Many critics of Pakistan's President Musharraf have been silenced. So have many journalists in the country. But my guest, journalist Ahmed Rashid, is currently visiting America and free to give his analysis of the situation. He's speaking to groups in Washington and New York, including military colleges. Rashid is best known in the West for his book Taliban, which was published in 2000 and became a bestseller after September 11th. He's also written about Islamic extremism through Central Asia. We check in with him from time to time to talk about the latest developments in Pakistan and on the Islamic extremist front. One of the subjects for today's conversation is the parliamentary election in Pakistan, scheduled for January 8th, which, as we'll hear, Rashid expects will be rigged. President Musharraf declared a state of emergency in early November, suspended the Constitution, and fired the Supreme Court. For 8 years, he was the head of the military as well as president. Ahmed Rashid, welcome back to Fresh Air. So since the last time we spoke, which was just a few weeks ago, Musharraf has stepped down as head of the military, but he remains president. Does he have any less power than he did before?
Well, he does have less power in the sense that there's a new army chief. So he has to contend now with a new army chief, even though the new army chief is very much a loyalist to him. All the senior generals, of course, very loyal to him. He had them placed specifically just before he resigned from the military so that, you know, he knew that he could trust them. But nevertheless, yes, I mean, you know, he does not command the army. And that is a new factor. And eventually down the road, the new chief is going to become his own man. At the moment, he may be very owing to Musharraf, but in a few months' time, if there's another crisis and Musharraf is at the center of that political crisis, then we are going to see the new military chief, General Kayani, acting very much on his own.
So the prime minister election is scheduled for January 8th. What's at stake in this election?
What nobody now expects is a free and fair election. I think there's absolutely no doubt that Musharraf and the intelligence agencies and the army are determined and united and have a common agenda in rigging the elections. Now, they're going to rig them, in my opinion, in such a way that the former political alliance that Musharraf was ruling with, that is the Pakistan Muslim League and a section of the religious Islamic parties, will once again form the government. In other words, the elections will be rigged in favor of the ruling coalition that has ruled for the last 5 years. I don't think that the deal that Musharraf had promised to the Americans regarding Benazir Bhutto, that she would come back, she would be allowed to contest in a free and fair vote, and she would probably win the elections in a free and fair vote and then become prime minister. I don't think that scenario is on the cards anymore. I think Benazir Bhutto, Musharraf has not obviously completed that deal. He's limiting her activities very much. And I think the elections are going to be rigged in the sense that she will be left with a certain number of seats in the opposition rather than in the government.
When you said that the elections will be rigged, like how will they be rigged?
Well, you know, there's been a lot of practice for this. I mean, we had very, very rigged elections in 2002. Now, this doesn't mean ballot stuffing, in fact. I mean, those are techniques of the past. The fact is that when all the results are being collated, they first go to a center, which is not publicly admitted to, of course, by the military. They go to an intelligence center of the ISI, that is the Inter-Services Intelligence. They're supposed to go directly from the counting stations to the Election Commission in Islamabad. Now, what happened certainly in 2002 was that these election results were first sent off to the ISI where they were dealt with. Now, how were they dealt with? Well, one of the easiest methods is if there is no real checking on the number of votes cast, you can decrease or increase the number of votes cast by the flick of a computer switch, basically. So you don't actually have to physically stuff ballot boxes. What you have to do is to fiddle with the number of votes cast in that particular constituency. That's one of the methods, and there are several other methods, not to speak of the kind of intimidation that has been going on before the elections, to get people who are standing, who might pose a threat to the government candidate, to get them to stand down and not to stand.
Tell us a couple of the basic things we should know about Benazir Bhutto and then about Nawaz Sharif. Let's start with Benazir Bhutto.
Well, she has been prime minister twice. There have been both times very controversial terms in office. She was thrown out for corruption, for incompetence, for a variety of other things. But there's very little doubt also that the army did and the intelligence services did help undermine her governments. So it's a mixture of her own failure and she being programmed to fail, you know, by the military. But the point about Benazir Bhutto is that she has a legacy of a party that has been started by her father, who was executed by the army in the 1980s. She took over the mantle of the party. And traditionally, this is a party that has been anti-army. It has been pro-democracy, anti-army. And it's been very anti-mullah, in other words, anti-fundamentalist. It's perhaps the strongest and the most widespread, if you like, secular party in Pakistan. So it has roots, you know, very deep roots in a section of the population that traditionally has been very anti-army and anti-extremist.
Now, Nawaz Sharif, he represents a more religious party.
Well, actually, you know, he represents what is today the ruling party, the Muslim League, which is what Musharraf is ruling with. Now, Nawaz Sharif has been prime minister twice, like Bhutto. Bhutto was his big rival in the 90s. His regimes were also marred with a lot of corruption and incompetence and attempts, in fact, to impose Islamic law at one stage. Since then, he's been in exile and he now claims to be a far more moderate person, much more in favor of democracy, opposed to military rule. He's taken a much tougher line against Musharraf than Benazir Bhutto has. He refuses to deal with him or work with President Musharraf. And he remains very popular in Punjab province. He's a Punjabi himself. Punjab is the largest province in the country, 65% of the population. And if you win the elections in Punjab, dramatically, you could probably win the whole parliament and become prime minister. So what happens in Punjab is very important.
In the meantime, Musharraf, at about the same time that he declared martial law, he sacked most of the judiciary. There's been a big protest by judges in Pakistan. Are most of the judges who Musharraf put in prison or under house arrest still in that condition?
Well, I think this is what has been really, really tragic. Musharraf deposed the judiciary, brought in new judges and made them swear an oath of loyalty to him. This, of course, finishes any idea of having an independent judiciary. Now, the former judges are still, most of them are under house arrest. They're surrounded by police. Nobody can visit them. Their telephones have been cut. You know, we're talking now about 7 weeks after the emergency. And it seems it's a major demand, of course, by human rights groups. The lawyers are still protesting in the streets. The law courts are still paralyzed. The law courts are not functioning at all, you know, at the lowest level or at the High Court and the Supreme Court level. So there is still a very strong protest movement. But unfortunately, there is no international support for a free and independent judiciary. The American position, for example, and the European position, nobody has asked for the restoration of the former judiciary. And there's a lot of disappointment, I think, in the sort of liberal elite and the liberal public, amongst the lawyers, with the international community, particularly with the Americans, that there is no demand for the restoration of the former judiciary. And the point here simply is, how can you have free and fair elections, I mean, if you've got this pliant judiciary? Because every time there's a charge of rigging, for example, you have to go to the courts. And the courts are just going to throw these charges out. There's going to be no fair hearing of rigging charges, for example. So how can you have a free and fair election when you've got a judiciary that has been, you know, set up by Musharraf?
And sworn allegiance to him. So what do you think that Europe and the United States could be doing?
Well, you know, I think there are three red lines which Musharraf has drawn, which I don't think the U.S. is challenging at all. The first red line is that the U.S. is demanding an independent judiciary, but is not demanding the restoration of the former judiciary. So I think Musharraf has won out on that. His first red line is that there will not be an independent judiciary. The army does not like an independent judiciary, and it will not allow one to happen. The judiciary has to be controlled by the military. I think that's the first red line. And that unfortunately, that seems to be accepted by much of the international community. I think the second red line he's drawing is that we are not going to have a free and independent press. There has been an enormous crackdown on the press, as you know. It has eased up. But all the major news channels, TV, satellite news channels, have been forced to sign a code of conduct with the military and the intelligence services of what they will run and not run. And secondly, the military has insisted that their key anchors, some of them, be sacked. And for these channels to come back, they've had to do that. So one channel, Geo, has refused to sign any of this and is still off the air, you know, even 6-7 weeks after the emergency. Now, again, the US is calling for a free and independent press, but it's not highlighting and pinpointing the kind of demands being made by the military, which are totally against a free and independent press. And I think the third red line he's drawn is that he will oversee the elections. In other words, he will rig the elections. And here again, we have an American demand that there must be free and fair elections, but there's no specific pointers to the military regime as to what it must do to ensure free and fair elections.
Do you think this is in part because Musharraf has been seen as an ally of the Bush administration, and maybe the Bush administration wants Musharraf to stay in power? So not intervening in the election is kind of a way of ensuring that?
I think that's very true. I mean, I think, you know, the Bush administration has been caught perhaps earlier between this rhetoric of wanting to promote democracy in the Muslim world, but also wanting to keep the sort of authoritarian rulers or tyrants that the US has supported in the Arab world, in the wider Muslim world, to keep them in power in place. I mean, we see, for example, about 2 years ago, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice's support for the democracy movement in Egypt, and then suddenly backing off after Vice President Dick Cheney and President Bush endorsed Mubarak, backing off that and then endorsing Mubarak. In similar ways, the democracy movement in other parts of the Arab world have really been stifled. So I think what we're seeing by the Bush administration as it faces so many setbacks in Iraq with the policy on Iran, we are seeing a return to support for authoritarian rulers really around the globe. And Musharraf is taking advantage of that, certainly.
We last spoke on Fresh Air in early November, and you were in Spain then for a conference. You've been back to Pakistan since then, up until a few days ago. So how has daily life in Pakistan changed for you and the people around you since the institution of emergency law?
Well, I missed the emergency, and a lot of my friends were in jail, and most of them have been released. So a lot of the time when I went back was spent actually in visiting people who had been in jail and taking their news and etc. These were, journalists, human rights workers, heads of, women NGOs, people who had been in jail for 2, 3, 4 weeks or under house arrest. So it's been a very sad time. I mean, and it's been perhaps, people have got even more depressed as the elections come up. And there is every indication that, these elections are not going to be free and fair. So the struggle in civil society, I think, amongst the lawyers, amongst the middle class continues. But of course, what has not happened and what has strengthened Musharraf is the fact that, there hasn't been a mass movement. I mean, you haven't had, millions and millions of people marching in the streets to kick out Musharraf. And that, of course, civil society, the NGOs, the lawyers, I mean, they can't organize that. That is up to the political parties and the political leadership. And the fact is that the political leaders are discredited in the public. I mean, the public in their millions are not coming out because they don't trust the political leadership, Benazir Bhutto, Nawaz Sharif, these opposition leaders, because they've tried and tested them before. So it's a very complex, dangerous and unpredictable situation.
We've talked before about the Taliban in Pakistan and Afghanistan. And the latest U.S. plan that we've heard about to help fight Islamic extremists in Afghanistan is a plan to arm Pakistani tribal forces on the border area between Afghanistan and Pakistan. This is a group called the Frontier Corps. This looks like it's a pretty controversial plan. Who is the Frontier Corps and what is the plan?
Well, the Frontier Corps is an 80,000-strong paramilitary force, largely made up of Pashtun tribesmen. The Pashtuns are the ethnic group from which the Taliban are drawn and which inhabit both the Afghan side and the Pakistani side of this common border between the two countries. Now, traditionally, under the British, it was a force raised by the British to help the British keep the peace in the tribal areas, and it was raised from the tribes themselves. But the Pakistani military, over the last 25 years, have used the Frontier Corps as a kind of cutting-edge frontline force to back up in the 1980s, first the Afghan Mujahideen fighting the Soviets and then the Taliban. So the Frontier Corps has become this kind of Islamist jihadist force, which for the last 25 years has been fighting for extremists, in Afghanistan as part of Pakistan's foreign policy in Afghanistan. It's been training these extremists. It's been fighting for them. So in my opinion, the Frontier Corps is a thoroughly, thoroughly unreliable force right now. Now, the American plan is that, let's arm them, let's give them helicopters and tanks, let's throw money at them as much as we can, and they're going to be this tribal force which is going to, help us win the war against terror. Well, I mean, the whole point about this is, I think, that the Frontier Corps, has to be revamped completely. It has to be restructured. It has to be screened. Its officer corps, its members, I think a lot of them are too closely linked to the whole jihadist philosophy to be of any use. So I think the Americans are throwing money. I mean, there are three separate ideas that the Americans are floating right now. One is to spend $350 million to arm the Frontier Corps. The other is to spend $750 million to carry out development projects in the tribal agencies themselves on the Pakistani side. And the third idea is to arm some of the Pashtun tribes to fight those Pashtun tribes who are helping al-Qaeda. In other words, to repeat what has been happening in Anbar province in Iraq. Now, I think all three projects are totally miscalculated and inappropriate. Unless there are demands put on the Pakistani military to reform the Frontier Corps, there's no point in giving this corps tanks and helicopters. Unless there are conditions put on Pakistan to reform the tribal agencies. In other words, the tribal agencies are at the moment outside the ambit of the Pakistan constitution. And thirdly, I mean, clearly this whole issue of arming tribe against tribe, I mean, you're going to create a civil war of horrendous proportions. The Pashtun tribes are already well armed. To imagine that, a new consignments of American arms are going to come in on one side, it's going to create a horrendous civil war. You don't have tribes there which are dedicatedly against al-Qaeda. Everyone will run around the Americans, take their money, take their weapons, and basically make fools of this whole American strategy.
Do you think that some of these tribes can be bought, that if we give the people enough money, that they'll join our side and fight against Islamic extremists, even if they had fought for Islamic extremists in the past?
You see, the problem, Terry, is that a few years ago, in other words, after 9/11, there were certainly tribes who intensely disliked al-Qaeda and the Taliban, and there were tribal elders, there was a civil society in these tribal agencies, there were, students, there were teachers, there were intellectuals, there were shopkeepers, there were businessmen, people, who were dead against the Taliban. And if the Pakistan government had carried out reforms at that time in these tribal agencies to bring these anti-Taliban Pashtuns on side, I think, we wouldn't be in the mess that we are today. Now, what has happened, unfortunately, is that you've had this very strong and ruthless Pakistani Taliban movement in the tribal agencies. Now, what have the Pakistani Taliban done? They've carried out a kind of ethnic cleansing amongst their fellow Pashtuns. Anyone opposing them has either been executed, with having his throat slit, or has been forced out to leave the area with his family and his belongings. So what we have left now in the tribe, in many of these tribal agencies, there are seven of them, and in about four of them, we have a totally Taliban population. In other words, we have the Taliban and their sympathizers. Anyone who opposes them is executed or driven out. Now, frankly, in this kind of situation, it's now, I think, political reform becomes even more imperative. Of course, it's much more difficult. It will take longer. You don't have the civil society to back your political reform right now. You've got to kind of bring them back and protect them and allow them to gain some status. And at the same time, you have to defeat the Taliban militarily. But, I mean, the problem is that you've allowed the situation to deteriorate now to such an extent that these Pakistani Taliban are no longer in competition with anyone. They are controlling territory and large chunks of the population.
You know, we spoke to Sarah Chase earlier this week, and she is a former NPR reporter who has been working on development projects in Afghanistan and has gotten to know the country very well in the past 6 years. And she says that Pakistan has been trying to exercise a kind of proxy control over Afghanistan. I wonder if you agree with that, and if so, if you would interpret that for us.
Well, you know, I mean, the military has, over the last 6-7 years, I mean, the military has had a very complicated position vis-a-vis Afghanistan. And unfortunately, the military has seen everything in Afghanistan through the prism of India. India is Pakistan's, long-standing enemy. Right after 9/11, the Indians, who had been, of course, had no presence in Afghanistan during the Taliban period, came back into Afghanistan, have had a very effective aid and development program in Afghanistan, etc. And the military has done its best to try and reduce the Indian presence in Afghanistan. Now, as part of that, it has also feared the Northern Alliance, that is the non-Pashtun warlords who helped defeat the Taliban back in 2001 and then ran the government for several years. I mean, they're no longer really running the government. But Pakistan has always distrusted the Northern Alliance because it has been backed by India and Iran and Russia. And thirdly, Pakistan has, for the last 10 to 15 years, certainly been trying to exercise a domination over the Afghan Pashtun population who live in the south and the east of the country. So as a mixture of all these policies, I think that is the reason why Pakistan gave sanctuary to the Taliban after 9/11. When they were routed by the Americans, they fled into Pakistan, and Pakistan has given them sanctuary. And it is from these sanctuaries in Pakistan that they've been going back and launching attacks in Afghanistan, and of course spreading their influence, and subsequently spawning the Pakistani Taliban. That is, you know, a similar type of movement on the Pakistani side of the border. So, you know, I wouldn't put the whole of the rise of the Taliban on blame the whole thing on Pakistan, because clearly the Taliban do have their own agenda, and they have resuscitated, not just with the help of Pakistan, but also with the help of Al-Qaeda and with the help of militant groups in the Middle East and militant groups in Pakistan. So the Taliban have had their own agenda and their own capabilities. But there's little doubt that without the sanctuary that Pakistan has provided them in the last few years, you wouldn't have had this expansion of the Taliban movement.
The last couple of times you've joined us on Fresh Air, you've warned that the Pakistan Taliban have spread out to some of the settled areas in Pakistan, and that they're exerting their control and forcing people in some areas to conform to a more strict Islamic code. Have you seen an increase in that in the past few weeks since we last spoke?
Well, in fact, since we last spoke, there has been an attempt by one militia, a sort of Taliban militia, to take control of the Swat Valley. Now, the Swat Valley is 100 miles north of Islamabad, the capital. It's a very developed valley. It's a very scenically beautiful valley. It's the center of tourism in Pakistan. You know, and as a consequence, it has a very good infrastructure, roads, electricity. 80% of the population is literate. And this Taliban militia, which has been growing there over the last 2 years, has not been stopped in any way by the military. They've been running their radio stations. They've got FM radio stations, and they run this hate propaganda, demanding Sharia, Islamic law, and hate propaganda against anyone who is not saying their prayers five times a day or doesn't support the Taliban. The military has been allowing all this to happen. And suddenly what I think happened in the last 3 or 4 weeks, this militia made a bid to capture the whole valley. And you had dozens of police posts falling to them, posts of the Frontier Corps falling to them. And finally, the army had to go in, went in, and has now cleared the rebels of the main towns, has driven them up into the mountains, but has not finished them. So, you know, you now have a full-scale war going on. Now, it's very unfortunate. If the military had done this 2 years ago, they wouldn't have needed such a big military operation. This militia was a very small militia. There was very little support for it at that time. You could have cleared up these few miscreants with probably a few policemen at that time. Now you've had to send 20,000 troops with tanks and helicopters into this valley, killing a lot of civilians, bombing, destroying a lot of these towns and people's homes and things, creating a huge exodus of refugees, creating a huge crisis, basically, about something that could have been resolved as a simple police operation 2 years ago.
Why didn't the Pakistani military do anything 2 years ago?
Well, I think, you know, this has been the tragedy of the Musharraf regime. I mean, I think they've been kind of blackmailing the West, and in particularly the American policymakers, by trying to demonstrate to them that, look, we are facing this fundamentalist threat here, and consequently, I am the only one who can protect American interests and fight these fundamentalists. And so the army has had this sort of dual-track policy of raising the threat of fundamentalism so that they can go to the Americans and say, look how serious the threat is. And then finally, after a lot of hesitation and allowing the threat to grow more and more and more, then finally deal with the threat. We saw this happening with the Red Mosque incident earlier this year in Islamabad, if you remember. This group of militants took over this mosque and held it for 6 months in the middle of the capital of the country. And the police could have moved in and cleared out these militants in the beginning. There were like 20, 30 militants. And after 6 months, there were 4,000 militants. And you had to send in the army. So again, you know, I mean, these are these sort of classic ways in which the military tries to get the sympathy of the Bush administration. And quite frankly, it's been working. And I think a lot of Pakistanis have contempt for the Bush administration for the ease with which they fall for this again and again and again.
My guest is the Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid, who's best known in the United States for his best-selling book, Taliban. And he's briefly in the United States to give a series of lectures in Washington and in New York. As part of your trip to the United States, you've been speaking to the military. What are those interactions like? I mean, who are you speaking to, and what do you think the people you're speaking to in the military are making of the kind of analysis that you're giving, which I assume is kind of similar to what you're telling us now?
Well, I've been speaking at military colleges, you know, where officers are doing courses and where the staff is trying to teach some of these things. And obviously, there are a lot of officers there who are back from Iraq, who perhaps are looking at the border regions and the Taliban through the eyes of their own experiences in Iraq. And to some extent, I think that's probably relevant, but in other extent, it's not. For example, this whole issue of arming the tribes, I mean, obviously, everybody was very interested in that. What happened in Anbar, what I understand, is that actually some of the Iraqi tribes came to the Americans and said, you know, we hate Al-Qaeda, they're harming our people, give us weapons, give us money, let us and arm us and let us fight them. And the Americans did so. Now, there's no comparable situation in the tribal areas, in the Pashtun tribal areas in Pakistan or on the border with Afghanistan, because the Taliban are Pashtun, number one. They are not outsiders. In Iraq, of course, many of the Al-Qaeda people are outsiders. They're not Iraqis. They're Saudis or they belong to other Arab nationalities. So in these border regions, the Taliban, first of all, are Pashtuns. Secondly, they've been using a mixture of terrorizing the local population by executions, by forcible recruitment of sons of villagers, etc. They've been terrorizing the population to make sure that the population does not resist them in any way. So I don't think anything is really comparable to the situation in Iraq. But it was very interesting. I mean, I think the military is the most skeptical. The U.S. military is the most skeptical about throwing money at problems. You know, I think the State Department and the CIA and certainly the White House have this idea that, you know, all you need to do is to throw money at the problem and the problem will go away. Well, I think, you know, the fact is that 7 years after 9/11, the extremists and terrorists in my part of the world are stronger than ever. American policies have failed to deal with extremism. They failed to catch Osama bin Laden, Mullah Omar, the Taliban leader, etc. We're in a much, much worse situation and a much more desperate situation where you've got these extremists spreading now in Pakistan, winning, if you like, in Afghanistan, being able to train these European groups who are plotting to launch more 9/11 type attacks in Europe. So I think, you know, there's an enormous concern amongst the US military as to why their policies have not been successful in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and what needs to be done.
I would just be interested in getting your quick reaction to the recent American National Intelligence estimate that said that Iran had basically stopped its secret nuclear weapons development program in 2003.
Well, I think at one level there's an enormous relief in Pakistan because what it means is that, you know, the Americans will really have no reason to attack Iran. And certainly what many Pakistanis and Afghans fear very much is a war with the United States, which would, of course, drag in all the neighboring countries. And both Pakistan and Afghanistan are neighbors of Iran. And these countries would be forced to take sides. And obviously they would side with the Americans, and the Iranians would then do as much as they could to undermine both the governments in Pakistan and Afghanistan. So at one level, there's enormous relief. But I think at another level, I mean, it really has confuse people, and it's going to lead to a lot of confusion. I think the whole credibility now of the U.S. intelligence establishment and the kind of judgments they make and the kind of spin given by the Bush administration is all in doubt. Now, tomorrow you're going to have national intelligence estimates about Al-Qaeda, about the Pakistani Taliban, about, you know, the Pakistani nuclear program, about etc., about proliferation, nuclear proliferation, about the viability of President Karzai being able to survive, etc. And I think really the problem now is that, you know, there's a lot of doubts will be cast upon these estimates, and the kind of seriousness with which these intelligence estimates were held, both by the American population, the American public, the American media, Congress, and of course abroad. You know, when American intelligence made an assessment, it has always been taken very seriously. Whether it was against you or in favor of you, it was taken very seriously. I think what this administration has done has been to completely destroy the credibility of these intelligence estimates, both for the American public and for foreign countries.
Well, Ahmed Rashid, I want to thank you very much for talking with us, and I wish you a good stay in the United States.
Thank you.
Ahmed Rashid is a Pakistani journalist and author of the bestseller Taliban. He's in the U.S. on a brief speaking tour.